Dan Pfeiffer was one of the first hired for Barack Obama's 2008 presidential run. He was also one of the president's longest-serving senior advisors. Now he's the co-host of the very popular podcast, Pod Save America, and he has a new memoir about his time working with Obama, titled Yes, We Still Can, Politics in the Age of Obama, Twitter, and Trump. The book stories his time in the White House and prescriptions for the future of the Democratic Party during President Trump's administration. We welcome Dan Pfeiffer to the roundtable this morning. Dan, thank you very much for being with us. Very nice to have you on the program.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Give us a sense of ultimately what you wanted to accomplish with the book. And maybe we start off with asking you at what point you started to think that you wanted to do a book.
Well, that sort of answers the question in itself, because I thought about writing a book when I left the White House back in 2015, and I didn't really know what story I wanted to tell. Like what angle could I take on the larger Obama experience that would be unique and hopefully interesting? And I actually came up with the idea for the book and started working on it, like in the most basic sense, the day after the 2016 election. When I was thinking back as to how it was possible that Trump won, I saw that many of the forces that led to a world where someone like Donald Trump could get elected were things that Barack Obama was battling every day. So I wanted to tell that story, how myself, President Obama, our team dealt with things like fake news and right-wing propaganda and changes in media, and try to extract some lessons for Democrats for the battles to come in 2018, 2020. And the other reason I wrote the book is, much like our podcast, Pod Save America, I wanted to write the book in the hopes that I could encourage young people. I wanted to tell a hopeful, hopefully funny at times, nostalgic story about politics in the hopes that we can encourage some young people to get involved in politics, whether that's as a profession or, you know, as a volunteer to help win these upcoming elections.
As of today, how difficult is it to be hopeful?
I understand why people, why progressives and Democrats can feel like there's no hope. I totally get that. Things seem dark. And even when you step back and you look at the broader forces in politics being marshaled by Trump, it can seem even darker. But the point of my book is to say there wasn't that long ago that we had a very different politics in this country, that we had a president who was thoughtful and decent and inclusive and valued diversity. And my message is it's conditional hope, that we can get back to that sort of politics. We can ultimately prove that Trump is an aberration on a path towards a better America, but it requires us doing the work. It requires us learning the lessons. It requires us marshaling the activism that's taken hold of this country. And if we do that, we can get there. So I'm not telling anyone it's going to be okay. I'm telling people it can be okay.
How rattled were those of you in the administration after the election and realizing you left in 2015, but obviously still had close ties? And at what point do you start to question what you accomplished? Meaning, is this election of 2016 a backlash to what you have done? And we've heard reports that even the president had that question.
I was out, as you point out, I was out of the White House, but myself and people I know who worked in the White House were shocked by the election. We thought Hillary Clinton was going to win, just like most people in politics. That was, you know, Donald Trump himself was shocked that he won. I tell a story in the book that were about a conversation with Barack Obama back in 2014, where he raises the prospect of the fact that maybe he had been like that as an African American president with a unique background, the middle name Hussein, that maybe he'd been elected too soon, and that there was a reaction in the Republican Party where they centered a political strategy around sowing racial division in this country. And that's what led to Donald Trump getting elected. And I am incredibly proud of all the work we did. I think it will stand the test of time in history, and Obama will go down as one of our most consequential presidents. But it is a reminder just how fickle politics is, and that we can live in a world where our first African-American president was replaced by a president who was known for saying racist things.
How did you get the job in the campaign?
I had been in Democratic politics for a while, working on mostly losing campaigns, and Barack Obama's chief of staff in the United States Senate, well, like many people in Democratic politics in the early 2000s, Barack Obama's chief of staff in the Senate had been my former boss, and he had been when I worked for Senator Tom Daschle when he was the Democratic leader of the Senate, and Pete Rouse was the man's name, and he introduced me to Barack Obama just when Barack Obama was thinking about staffing up his campaign. We met for an hour, and I had walked out of the meeting. I never met Barack Obama before. Walked out of that meeting, having accepted a job without knowing how much money I was going to make, what my title was going to be, and when I was going to have to move to Chicago.
And at what point in that, you write about this in the book, at what point did he say to you, how often do you get to push your shoulder against the wheel of history and push?
He said that in that meeting, and what was interesting about that meeting was Barack Obama, you know, unlike many politicians, just came off as a very down-to-earth, normal, humble human being. But I had met with lots of candidates who were thinking about running for president that year or in previous years, and they always tell you why they're going to win or how they're going to win. You know, I have this secret poll that says if only I get known in Iowa, I'll rocket to the top. In the course of that entire meeting, Barack Obama never told me how he was going to win. He only told me why he wanted to run and what he would do if he was going to win. And that was his point about saying, putting your shoulder against the wheel of history, is that there was an opportunity here to do something real and do something exciting. And those don't come around that often. And, I mean, I have been so fortunate and privileged that he gave me the opportunity, and I said yes in that moment.
Given that you were in that primary going up against Hillary Clinton, was there a sense, or I'm wondering when the campaign started to gain confidence that you could really have a message that would unify the Democratic Party?
Well, we started out like gangbusters, right? People were flocking to our rallies. We were raising money. There was just this palpable excitement. You know, we would show up in a place like Austin, Texas, for a Democrat. And, you know, and Barack Obama had been in the Senate for 2 years, and we get 25,000 people to show up, 20,000 people in Oakland. And it was like, we knew there was something real happening. And maybe we were naive. Right, we had drank the Kool-Aid, or we were enthralled, is that we really thought we had a very, very good chance to win the whole time. And even when the polls said we were down 30 points, and yeah, there were dark moments, of course, but we knew what our strategy was. We had faith in our candidate, we had faith in our team, and I think maybe it's the naivete of the young that we believed from the beginning, and it turned out to be that many people do that and turn out to be wrong. We did that and turned out to be right.
You tell a story in the book, and it's a really interesting meditation on fake news. And you write about the birther conspiracy. And when the White House first has to deal with this, you just think it's going to go away because it's just sort of a nut theory, right? And then at some point, you actually have to take it seriously.
Yeah, that was the lesson in this, is that, you know, we dealt with this first in the campaign. There are these email forwards going around all over the country alleging that Barack Obama was not born in America. And we were starting, it was mostly happening on the kooky side of the right wing, but we were starting to hear from Democratic activists about it who were saying, like, for going to people's doors, and people were asking them this question, like, you know, I think they probably wanted to support Obama, but they're like, well, but if I heard he's not eligible to be president, or if we nominate him and this comes out, will we lose again? And so at that time, we put out the table that's known as the Certificate of Live Birth, which is the summary of the birth certificate. And that sort of mattered for Democrats. And it went away. And it came back when a man we now know to be President Donald Trump started going on television everywhere, alleging that he had information that proved that Barack Obama was not an American. And the old school communications theory would be, don't give oxygen to the crazy, right? The only way, it's not going to get attention unless you speak to it. And that is a theory that I abided by, but it was a theory that died right about the time the internet was invented. And we were forced in this position where we had to put out information because we had to address it, because it was, you know, via the internet, especially Facebook, it was filtering into people's consciousness, and we had an answer, and we decided to take a step, and it was a risky decision at the time, but to put the information out, and it helped, but it didn't solve the problem, because there's still a disturbing number of Republican voters who think Barack Obama wasn't born in America.
I mean, in one way, it's kooky and it's childish, but also it's racist, and how willing and or how unwilling was the administration/president to label it as racist?
That's a good question. And like it had, the racial undertone seemed so obvious that it wasn't necessary to say it explicitly, although I think we did at times. And look, we saw this is something that was present throughout President Obama's campaigns and White House, is they, you know, we're sort of two competing like threads in America, right? Like you sort of have to take yourself back into time to think. Most people thought it was impossible that America would elect an African-American president in 2008, let alone one who was named Barack Hussein Obama, right? You know, father from Kenya, lived in Indonesia. It was, you know, someone with that sort of unusual story, that would be impossible. Yet, we traveled the country. We met with independents, Republicans, all across rural Iowa, one of the whitest states in the country, and people didn't care that Barack Obama was black. They cared about who he was, what he stood for, and who he was going to fight for. And so, like, people, and I think that was some of the joy in the country around the 2008 election, was that maybe we are better than we think we are as a country. Maybe there is more decency than we maybe assume. But at the same time, you did see this radicalization among a fringe about concern about African American president, and that has grown over time. It is still a minority of the minority, but the vocalness of it and the normalization of it under this new administration is very concerning.
Dan Pfeiffer is the author of the new book, Yes, We Still Can, Politics in the Age of Obama, Twitter, and Trump. Considering this social media platform is in the subtitle of the book, you do write about Twitter. You certainly say that it's valuable, and you feel the Democrats should do a better job in using it.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I don't think the world is better off because Twitter's around. I think we've seen some pretty negative consequences from it, but it is here. It is, because it is the place where politicians are, it's a place where engaged political activists are, and most importantly, it's the place where reporters spend most of their time analyzing, commenting, sharing information. It is a place where the primary political conversation happens in this country, and it filters off Twitter to other social media platforms and also to TV. You know, what trends on Twitter tends to be what trends on TV, as opposed to the opposite. And so we have to become adjusted to this world. And I'm not saying in any way that people should tweet like Trump, should act like Trump, but he has found a way to use Twitter to communicate in a way that is compelling to his supporters, at least. And we have to tweet more like humans and less like political robots if we want to have success on this platform. You have to speak in the language of the platform. That doesn't mean you have to be racist or angry or have lots of typos, but it does mean you have to speak like a human. And some younger Democrats are really good at it. Others are not great, but it's going to be important for whoever our 2020 nominee is to be able to hold their own in this platform.
I agree with you entirely, but I feel compelled to ask the question, but even if it is filled with, if it's racist and angry and filled with spelling errors, and it still works, what does that say about us?
I think it says something about 38 to 42% of voters, which is about 15% of the country.
Yeah.
And I think it's always worth remembering that. People are like, Trump has a very specific strategy that no president has taken, and certainly that I can think of, which is presidents speak to the entire country. People who voted for them, people who voted for their opponent, and people who didn't vote at all. Trump only speaks to this one group of people, and what he says works with them. But it is a minority of the minority. And unfortunately, it is a third, to 4/10 of the voting public, but we can change, we can dilute that by having more people vote, which is one of the reasons that we spend so much time on Positive America, and I spent to write this book, was to encourage people to vote if they weren't going to vote, register people to vote, get more people to vote, because it's only 38% if only 50% of Americans vote, right? If 70% of Americans vote, it's a much smaller percentage.
When Roger Ailes calls you a real dick, how proud are you of that?
I'm pretty proud. I'm pretty proud. And I think I was proud of it in 2010. And now that I know even more about Roger Ailes that has come out in recent years, I mean, obviously he has passed away since then, but he was an even worse human being than I imagined. So I feel even more proud in that sense.
And that's politics, right? I mean, that's also this of you better than anyone knows what it's like to go from a campaign to an administration, and the sort of the machinations of that. And there's really nothing overly glamorous about it. It's a very messy business, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, working in the White House is the privilege of a lifetime. If you cannot be excited and proud every day you walk through those doors, then you should not be there. But it is also a job, and it's a hard job. in the sense that they're all the easy stuff gets done and figured out before it gets to the White House. Only the tough decisions come there. And then even only the toughest ones get to the president's desk. And so you're making a lot of it's hard and it's chaotic and it's messy and you are buffeted by events at all times. And so it's different. It is, campaigns are hard too, but they are nothing compared to being in the White House, because the consequences of your actions are so broad and dramatic that if the press secretary says the wrong thing, it can cause international incident or sink the markets. If a piece of information gets out before it's supposed to, it could upend a diplomatic deal. These are all it's real stuff, and it's not hard, but it's not easy, but boy, am I glad I got the opportunity to do it.
Have you had conversations with the president since leaving?
I have. It's been a few months now. I see him when I come through D.C. or if I get the opportunity to, and I've done some, I try to, we always say you could, when people would leave the White House, we'd say you could leave the building, but you can't leave the Obama family. And it's a similar thing. Like all of us who've worked for him, we'll pitch in here or there. We'll provide advice on a certain thing that his office may be doing now. We'll be helpful. And so as I write in the book many times, he is as good a person as many of his supporters would hope that he would be. And I am incredibly grateful that I had the opportunity to know him. And in the 10 years that, now 11 years that I have known him, never once has he ever caused me to question my decision to go work for him.
Hmm. You end the book on this, we're going to miss him. So what do you make of his post-presidency? He's obviously very early into it. And I'm just curious as to what you think that time will be like.
Well, you're right. He's at the very beginning of figuring out what his foundation is going to do. I've been watching it closely. I'm very excited. I think he's headed to Africa right now to go continue a lot of the really good work he did on that continent, particularly working with young leaders to try to build a generation of civil servants and members of civil society in those countries. And I think he was a young man when he got to the presidency. He's still a young man. He'd be the first to tell you. And I think he's going to do great things. And I think, there is this question of, like, what role is he going to play in politics? And I think you will see him out on the campaign trail in 2018 trying to help elect Democrats up and down the ballot. I think that'll be very helpful for the party's effort and great for a lot of us to see, because we miss him.
Is there, and I mean, this is the question that everybody wants an answer to, so I'll ask you. Who's our next Barack Obama? Like, who's the person that the left can put faith into, and especially, by the way, snap it up, because make it snappy, because the election season is upon us, and I think many people look and say, well, where is the leadership and the rising star that we saw in Barack Obama very early on in 2009?
The answer is we don't know. I don't know. If I knew, I would, I'd probably go work for that person right now. And I think it's important to know that presidential elections are a match between the person and the moment. And at this point in the 2000, Obama ran in 2008. We were having this conversation in 2006, no one would have brought up Barack Obama's name. In fact, there was a book called The Way to Win that was written by some of the most prominent D.C. political journalists about how to win the 2008 presidential campaign, what it meant to win a campaign. And in the entire book, you would not find two words, Barack or Obama. And so we just don't really know what that moment is going to look like. And you don't also really know, like, Barack Obama, prior to starting to actually run for president and show up in living rooms in Iowa and New Hampshire and elsewhere, he was an idea. He gave a good speech, but did he have the mettle to go through a tough presidential campaign? Did he have the ideas? Did he have the discipline? Could he do more than just give a speech? And we don't know that of any of these candidates until they get out there. So that's why I am actually one of the few people who was encouraged that there are like 75 people thinking of running. I think that is great. I hope they all run, and it'll be a big friendly debate within the Democratic Party about strategy, message, policy. And then I think we'll figure out who our next leader is through that process. And I am hopeful. Look, we got a lot of work to do, but I am hopeful that we got some pretty exciting people out there who might be able to do it.
Again, I agree with you, but do you think Democrats historically are good at big and friendly and debating?
Yeah, I mean, look, primaries are heated. We had, like, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, we went at each other for a year and a half. And, you know, and sometimes it got a little overheated, but most of the time it was a civil debate. And at the end of that process, Hillary Clinton endorsed Barack Obama, and then Barack Obama made her Secretary of State. And so I think it can absolutely happen. We'll see what the state and mood of the party is come that time. But I think we can do it. We did it in 2004 too. I think we are usually better at this than Republicans at the presidential level. So, and the people who are running who are thinking of running. No one has told me they're running. If they did, I would share it with you. But the people who I've read are thinking of running are people who I think they like each other, and I think I think that the odds are good, at least, that we can have a good debate here.
Dan Pfeiffer is former White House Communications Director and co-host of Pod Save America. The new book, Yes, We Still Can, Politics in the Age of Obama, Twitter, and Trump. It's published by 12. Dan Pfeiffer, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.